From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report. It is the 20th day of December 2019. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo. He's at globalanalytics.biz out of Atchison, Kansas. A bit later in the program, Scott Irwin will join us. He's been traveling with me all week long at the Illinois Farm Economic Summits. We're here in Champaign at the iHotel today. No update, by the way, of the commodity markets, at least prices, because I'm recording a bit early in the afternoon in order to fit everything in. Also today, we'll talk about the weather forecast, that with Eric Snodgrass of Agrible and Nutrient Ag Solutions, and we'll get an update of what's been happening in the world of agricultural policy and a couple of things this week, the USMCA and the RFS, that with the executive director of the Illinois Corn Growers Association on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Mike Zuzulo from globalanalytics.biz now joins us out of Atchison, Kansas to take a look at the marketplace. Hey, I hope you've had a good week before Christmas and that you're looking forward to a fantastic break. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Todd, I'm so excited for another Christmas to come. And, you know, we here in our family, because we're a small business, really count you and the Will Radio is one of our many blessings. And we thank you for all you do for us and getting us on the air and letting us share our opinions with the marketplace and with all the great producers and ranchers out there, and wishing everybody a Merry Christmas.
Well, thank you, too. You know, without all of you, that this programming would not work. And I've always felt that you and WILL are part of the family, so I appreciate that much. Speaking of which, as part of the family, we probably ought to discuss what all of this past week, maybe politically to begin with, means. There are a couple important things yesterday, and we'll hear more about this in a second. The House of Representatives passed overwhelmingly USMCA, and at the same point in time, we had bad news from the RFS. How do you see those two things working for producers over the next, oh, I don't know, 2 or 3 months?
You know, I think the USMCA and the signatures and the agreement on the Phase 1 U.S.-China trade deal being talked about by Secretary of Treasury Mnuchin, which is supposed to be coming now in early January, could have offset, and more than offset even, the RFS news, biofuel policy news for 2020. But I think that the trade clearly has skepticism still built up from a standpoint of whether we can actually get $40 billion of U.S. agriculture exports over into China the next 2 years in a row. I believe we can for a variety of reasons. And Friday morning, JCI China came out. They're a very well reputable Chinese analytical firm in the commodity industry over there, and suggested the exact same thing, that the Chinese will need that much when it comes to DDGs, when it comes to sorghum. It's not just all about soybeans, but soybeans are a big part of it because of the hog herd trying to be rebuilt due to African swine fever. But the trade clearly, I think, this week has shown us that it is not ready to buy into the idea that we're going to see a doubling of demand by China.
What things did JCI put in that list? I saw soybeans for sure. Corn and wheat were there as well, but I don't know about how much of a raise.
Yeah, corn and wheat were in the top five, and DDG snuck in there, and sorghum snuck in the top six. $18.7 billion was soybeans, $2.1 billion was pork, $2.5 billion were nut imports, and then another billion for U.S. chicken. But then you look at the balance of that, they projected actually $41.3 billion. The balance minus the soybeans and the pork and the nuts and the U.S. chicken feet can come in other commodities, including wheat and corn and DDGs and sorghum. And so it was big numbers across the board, and very needed numbers, I think, for the United States. As far as the trade and some of the media in here in the western part of the world suggesting it's just not going to happen. I think this will go away kind of like impeachment once we actually get the signature with China, because China's essentially said, we're not going to tell you much until we sign the deal, and then we'll let out our details. And I think that's the missing link right now.
Yeah, so all of this, I assume, along with some of the fundamentals just in the production side from the United States, have been making you friendly to the marketplace over the last month or so?
Yeah, you know, I'm moving in my 2020 outlook at this stage and going to get some stuff posted next week or the first of the year time period. Still trying to dot the I's and cross the T's. But I can say this right now, Todd. I think that we are moving now with USMCA passing, with this phase one trade deal going forward, and with the impeachment not being a reason fundamentally for the dollar to become, and all those factors for that matter, becoming a dollar safe haven bid cause, or a reason for the dollar to become a safe haven bid again and be bought again. If we don't have that, I think we're starting out 2020 as we started out 2019. NAFTA had gotten signed. The new NAFTA had gotten signed back in November of 2018. We hadn't racked up a lot of trade frictions with China or Europe at that point. And we saw what happened the first half of 2019, a very nice market. And then June, July came in, and all of a sudden we saw the dollar get bought because the frictions started to really get ramped up. I could see a very similar situation. And on top of that, because of our short crop, I think we still have to deal with in subsequent USDA reports and some of the issues in South America, Australia, and other areas we've talked about this year. I think we actually are starting off on a better footing in terms of supply side for both corn and beans. Not as much wheat domestically, but globally, I think there's less competition for wheat as well. So I see a good upside potential in 2020, especially the first half, if we keep everything smooth sailing and the dollar isn't bought.
What are you telling producers about the 2020 crop then, and locking in prices, if anything at all?
Yeah, I am. And this is where I think we're going to be using similar numbers on revenue per acre. This past year, I was looking at 800-850 gross revenue per acre on corn. I would probably say that's a great number to be using again, especially if you're in that area of Illinois that can, you know, hit 200 bushel whole field yields. If you're looking at 175, you may have to drop that back $25 or $50 an acre as far as where you start to sell. The same thing with beans, you know, that 600, 550 area is, I think, a good area to start selling. One difference in 2020 I see versus 2019 at this point anyway is the idea that maybe we're starting at the bottom of a 3 to 4 year cycle. I could see this 2020 being very similar to 1994 in the aftermath of a 1993 type flood year, where we have demand come on and it's 3 to 4 years of demand, or similar to what we saw after 2003, where we had 2004 through 2008, a very strong 3 to 4 year cycle. I think that's something you might want to build into your marketing plan, so you're not overselling your bushels, you're keeping a very strong track of your APH levels of sales, and you're giving yourself a little bit more upside potential maybe, especially if we do have smooth sailing between now and the middle of the year in 2020.
And for old crop?
I just made another 20% of insured bushel increment sale on soybeans at 930. Only because it got us up close to the 2019 highs. And I do feel like beans are carrying a bit more of a premium versus the corn and wheat as this China deal got passed. Corn, I'm still holding pat with a large amount of cash bushels in the bin. Still looking at basis contracts in certain specific areas where you're up at or above your five-year average. So really a lot heavier sold in the beans and 19 beans, and still being more patient with 20 beans.
Have you done any pre-January crop production report work yet?
Well, I think we're going to see harvested acres drop before yield, just because of how 29 treated us and how the USDA stopped doing the crop progress reports a couple weeks ago. It's going to be hard for them to get test weights and yield numbers between now and springtime, I feel like. And it's probably more likely that when you've got 5 million acres sitting out in five key states of the Northern Plains and Northern Corn Belt, probably going to be easier for them to drop harvested acres in corn and beans before they do anything with yield. So January numbers, I think that's where we're headed, a drop in harvested acres. My final carryover numbers haven't really changed that much, still around that 460, 450 level in soybeans, and still down around a 1.5 to 1.6 carryover when it comes to the corn. I think this weekly marketing year highs in wheat and corn export sales made me feel like, okay, we do have some upside potential on the demand side, with Mexico being our number one buyer this past week.
A couple of macroeconomic things. Do you feel like the dollar will continue to slide?
I think it should fundamentally, Todd. I think our trade deficit is still wide enough that it needs to. The key to 2020 for me, and this is why it's a lot like 2019, is that if we've been buying the U.S. dollar and the U.S. equity markets, we've been shorting the emerging markets and the emerging market currencies. If we reverse that spread, if we go long emerging markets in the global financial world and we sell the dollar and buy those emerging market commodities, currencies, then the commodities, hard assets, are going to be looked more favorably upon. That I think is the trick here at this point, is to convince the market that we're on the low of global economy, on the low of international trade, heading higher, with the stock market probably, in my opinion anyway, already having priced in a good portion of a strengthening economy as we go into 2020.
Hey, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Todd.
You have a good holiday now.
You too.
That, of course, is Mike Zuzlo. He's with GlobalAnalytics.biz. Well, I've been traveling all week. I've been watching the news, but not particularly reporting on it. So I thought maybe we better catch up on a couple of things that have happened this week. USMCA, of course, was passed by the House, I think, yesterday. And then, of course, there was some there was some information coming out about ethanol and the RFS. Rodney Weinzierl, who's the director of the Illinois Corn Growers, is here. Can you give me an update of where we are politically today?
Yeah, Todd, yesterday, Thursday this week, the House representative passed USMCA. I think people were really surprised by the strength of support that there was there for USMCA, the Mexican and Canadian agreement. In Illinois, we had 17 of our 18 congressional members in support of it. The Democrats actually had one more vote than Republicans for it, 193 to 192. So that's a lot of strength going into the Senate. I think, it's something that we need to be continuing to work on in the Senate, but there's a lot of momentum now. And I think USMCA hopefully will get through the Senate here sometime yet in January.
And then on the Trump administration's view of ethanol and the RFS, another setback this week.
Right. EPA came out with their final rule that related to the small refinery exemptions that EPA has been giving out over the last couple of years. They've indicated that they're going to stay with their plan, which we believe was not what was agreed to back in October, and that plan was to use DOE recommendations how RINs would be reallocated, renewable identification numbers that small refineries would be exempted from having to utilize. And what our concern is, EPA has never followed DOE recommendations yet. And so they're saying we're going to in the future. And so the proof will be in the pudding here over the next 12 months as to see whether they actually follow through or not. And we're just really skeptical whether EPA is going to change course as to what they've been doing the last couple of years.
Hey, thanks for the update. That, of course, is Rodney Weinzierl. He is with the Illinois Corn Growers Association. Well, hey, let's check the weather forecast now, as we always do on a Friday, with Eric Snodgrass from Agribull and Nutrient Ag Solutions. Thanks for being with us, Eric. Can you give me some indication of what this next 7 days will look like?
Well, Todd, I'm looking here at a map that shows us the next 7 days of total accumulated precipitation from this morning's European model. And it's pretty amazing because we see across much of the Corn Belt, including the state of Illinois, of course, a very dry pattern. In fact, it's also a pattern that's going to be seeing a lot of much warmer than average temperatures. So the snow that we have on the ground right now will be melting in the coming days, as we're going to start to see high temperatures creep up in around 50 degrees. Now, where's all the adverse weather? Well, over the next 4 to 5 days, it's really going to be in the southeast, where there's a large low pressure system forming here just off the coast, and it's going to be just dumping enormous amounts of rains over part of the Cotton Belt, for example, down there in Mississippi all the way over to the Carolinas. And the Northwest is also getting a lot of precipitation, and the Northwest desperately needs this, as they're actually one of the regions in the U.S. right now that is in drought. But coming back to the midsection of the country with the warming trend that we are on and the melting of the snow and the fact that I don't think we're going to see much in the way of precipitation all the way and through next Friday, even beyond that, is going to paint for a pretty nice travel time period here in and around Christmas in the midsection of the United States. Now, we are watching a couple of things. There is a system on Christmas Day that we do need to keep a close eye out on. Very light precipitation that moves through like parts of Iowa toward Minnesota and Wisconsin. But this is not one of those big kind of end-all, be-all low-pressure systems that can just destroy our ability to travel during the holiday. But I'll tell you this, when we look out at week two, so this would be starting next Friday, going to the Friday after that, which gets us all the way into the new year, that time period becomes quite active for us. We have a trough that dips in out of the West Coast and sets up right over the Four Corners states. And as you know, we talk about it all the time, that is a flow pattern that spreads a lot of moisture right out of the Gulf of Mexico into the midsection of the United States. So we're going to go back over to a very active pattern. And it's been that way for a while. We seem to have like a week on, then a week off, and then a week on, then a week off. And it's all because we are watching carefully the transition that is happening in the Pacific Ocean. And we've been talking for months about how strong this Indian Ocean dipole event. We've also talked about how there is no El Nino signal right now. Well, the Indian Ocean dipole event is collapsing, and while we still wait to see if we get any sort of a El Nino or even La Nina-like circulation out of the Central Pacific, it seems that the North Pacific is going to take over. So you have some warm water that extends in and around Hawaii and stretches all the way up into the Gulf of Alaska. And that is, throughout the month of January, going to favor a lot more ridging in the Gulf of Alaska, with a strong subtropical branch of the jet stream that sneaks south of it and cuts right through the southeastern parts of the Ohio River Valley. So what does all that mean? Well, enjoy the warmth while it lasts. And we may have warmer than average conditions that kind of persist into the beginning of January here. But after that, I do see a couple of things taking place. One, there is right now building up over in Siberia and Alaska some pretty cold air. And a lot of times we can take a lot of that cold air and easily pull it toward the south, coming over the North Pole actually first, and then toward the south here into the eastern half of the United States. And that may set up for the second week of January, which means we're going to go back over into a full-blown winter-type pattern, it looks like right now at that time in January. One complicating factor, we still have yet to see the polar vortex, which remembers in the stratosphere, fully connect with the troposphere, the layer we live in. And when it does, that could upset things as well. So speaking of upsetting the weather, with the collapse of the Indian Ocean dipole, it appears that the Madden-Julian Oscillation, which will now become the dominant tropical circulation, is going to come out over into phases 6, 7, and then move over toward phase 8, and then back around to phase 1 and 2. Now, what does all that mean? Well, in the near term, that means that the chances for it being wetter than normal in the month of January for much of Brazil's northern growing regions is pretty high. It means that Argentina may be on the drier side of things moving forward. In North America, it means that the eastern half of the country will likely start off warm in January, but transition to a colder, more active pattern. But what we need to pay attention to is how the MJO finally comes around out of 7 and 8, 1 and 2, over into phases 3, 4, 5, and 6. Those would be the next phases that we would see toward the end of the month of January, the beginning of February. And those would be the drier phases of the MJO. Now, if that comes in for the drier phases of the MJO in South America, that could potentially impact how the first crop of beans, which did go in late compared to a year ago, finishes up. And we're going to watch that very carefully with each one of our Friday updates, because that'll be the most critical, I think, weather news globally and how we're going to be affecting the production of our major grains and oil seeds. So we'll keep a close eye on it, but I'm telling you, in the tropics, the new name of the game is going to be the Madden-Julian Oscillation. So we're going to talk about that for the next several weeks.
Thanks, Eric. Eric Snodgrass is with Agrible and Nutrien Ag Solutions. Well, as I'm sure you remember and know, we've been traveling all week with the Illinois Farm Economic Summits. The leadoff hitter at each and every day this week has been Scott Irwin. He's taking a look back at what happened in 2019 and joins us now. I want to just go straight to your summary page here and to talk about acreage, in particular, what prevent plant looked like when these numbers started to come out in June and July and then in August. Farmers, even ag economists were appalled to begin with. Can you give me some sense of how the numbers came about and what farmers did in reaction to a couple of different events through the year? Of course, the rain that delayed them and then the MFP payments.
Right. So I think the way to think about it, Todd, is that we started the year with a total base from 2018 of about 180 million acres planted for corn and soybeans. That's the base from 2018. And we want to account for all those acres in 2019. And what was, I think, difficult to absorb initially was the clever strategy that farmers took about how they were going to divide that pie up in 2019.
So what did they do? What was this genius strategy, as you say in the presentation?
Well, it really was, given the incentives that were in front of them and what they knew about the market facilitation program, the second round that you were supposed to be having to plant something to get it, what they did was roughly said, I'm going to plant all of the corn I originally intended to plant, but I'm also going to take a lot of prevent plant for corn as well. But based on the flexibility that is built into the crop insurance program, they were able to take the prevent plant acres out of intended soybean acres, not intended corn acres. And that little piece of genius creative decision making was not obvious at first.
You call this a term. What do you use for it?
I call this the great informal set-aside program for soybeans of 2019.
So farmers took care of two things in one fell swoop.
That's right. You know, they had to adjust to the extraordinary late planting conditions and the commodity that was by far and away in most excess surplus in 2019 was soybeans. I mean, we were looking at a carryout on soybeans of probably close to a billion bushels at that time. And so farmers said, wow, we can whack that in one year by taking account of this flexibility that really probably wasn't well understood, even by most ag economists, fully as we went into this period. But farmers definitely figured it out.
So they figured it out. What do the numbers actually look like? So when you think about it, farmers planted how many acres of corn, how many acres of soybeans, and do the numbers really play out given the historical averages of these crops?
Yep, they do. They add up. We planted about 90 million acres of corn and prevent plant a little over 11 million acres. And we only planted 76.5 million acres of soybeans, so that was a drop of 12.7 million acres. And so the key is to compare the drop in planted soybean acres of 12.7 million and the prevent plant on corn was 11.4 million acres, not a coincidence. And so you add up all of the planted corn and soybeans and prevent plant corn and soybeans and it adds up to a little over 180 million acres.
Hey, thanks so much. And boy, I assume most farmers hope that 2020 is not a lot like 2019.
I think we all have that hope, Todd.
Scott Irwin is an agricultural economist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois.